Hey, so the last few weeks we've been talking about one of the major forces that's deforming the people of God, which is a post-Christian sexual vision. And a couple weeks ago, we started talking about a more compelling and beautiful vision, which is the uniquely Christian sexual vision. And today what I want to do is just add two things to the conversation that I think are going to at first sound a bit unusual, but I think they're deeply connected to a historic Christian approach to counterformation around sexuality. And I think these are two things we really need to rediscover today. So let me give you two things. The first thing is I want to talk about sexuality and restored agency. And then I want to talk about sexuality and eschatology. So sexuality and restored agency. How many people in this room are consistently discouraged that you still sin? How many people still have places where you're sinning in the same categories you were sinning a decade ago and it drives you crazy? I've been married for almost 24 years, and there's still times where the sense of entitlement I bring to my marriage is so gross and so disgusting, and I keep trying to mortify that thing, and it keeps popping up in different ways. And it's so discouraging. Okay, but let me ask you a different question. How frequently are you amazed that you don't always sin? Okay, probably not very often, but here's the thing that's incredible. In the fall, we fell into slavery to sin. Our wills were so bound up with sin that we were free to choose what we wanted, but we never chose God. We chose God's stuff, we chose idols, we chose rebellion, we chose blasphemy, but we could not and would not ever choose obedience to God and the beauty of his law. But here's what Paul says in Romans chapter 6. What then? Are we to sin because we're not under law but under grace? By no means. Do you not know that you present yourselves to anyone as obedient slaves? You are the slaves of the one whom you obey, either of sin, which leads to death, or of obedience, which leads to righteousness. But thanks be to God that you were once slaves of sin. You have become obedient from the heart to the standard of teaching which you were committed. And having been set free from sin, you have become slaves of righteousness. Okay, here's a dynamic we don't talk about in our struggle with sexual sin and our spiritual formation. The gospel of Jesus Christ restores our agency. And we now have spirit-wrought empowerment to actually choose what's beautiful and true, to go to war with our flesh, to not yield to our flesh. And certainly until the great day, we're going to continue to struggle with sin. We're going to continue to fall. There's a day coming where we're going to be glorified and we will be free permanently and eternally to only obey. But the work of Jesus and the power of the Spirit truly does restore our agency. So I want you to think about the Great Commandment for just a second and how that should shape our ethics around sexuality. Let me read this to you. This is Matthew chapter 22. When the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. And one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. Teacher, what is the greatest commandment in the law? And he said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets. Okay, here's what's wild. That's not the gospel, but the gospel has the power to set us free to actually live in light of these two beautiful commandments, to shape a life around these commandments. The summary of the law in these two commandments that once simply revealed our idolatry and our selfishness is now a signpost. It's an invitation to worship and service. So let's think about marriage and singleness in light of worshiping God and serving our neighbor. Marriage and sexuality and singleness and sexuality in light of worship and service. Let's talk about marriage just real quickly. A husband's love for his wife when it comes to worship is an offering to God in response to God's fidelity and pursuit of us in Jesus. That's Ephesians chapter 5, is it not? So like, actually, in the context of marriage, offering fidelity to your wife, honoring your wife, caring for your wife, bearing with your wife in honor as the weaker vessel, these are ways in which you're not just being kind to your wife. When rightly understood, this is a way in which we're responding to the grace of God in Jesus. We're offering spiritual worship. We're becoming living sacrifices. A wife's submission to her husband. It's not just about her husband. We see this in 1 Peter, that actually, as she responds to her husband and trusts God in doing so, she's offering to God worship that flows from trust and confidence that he keeps his promises. So in the context of marriage, listen, the great commandment starts to flesh its way into our relationship where we start to get to ask the question, how might I worship God in the context of this relationship? mutual fidelity in marriage. Forsaking sexual sin, being true to your spouse, is rooted and grounded in God's covenantal fidelity to us. And as we return fidelity back to God, and as we cultivate fidelity in our marriages, that is worship. It's worship. Now let's talk about service. Paul said some things that were completely radical. They don't seem as radical today, but that's because the power of the gospel has been affecting culture for 2,000 years. In a pagan first century context, what Paul taught about marriage and sexuality and singleness was so radical. In some ways, next to Christians caring for the poor, the Christian sexual vision was the primary thing that both repulsed and was attractive to the pagan world. Listen to this in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights. That would have blown pagans' minds. And likewise, the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by an agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer and then come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. The expression of sexual intimacy in marriage, Paul is framing around mutual service and mutual honoring. That husbands, you don't own your body, your wife does. And wives, you don't own your body, your husband does. As a husband serves his wife sexually, as a wife serves her husband sexually in that mutuality, here's what we see. It's the outflow of the great commandment, love the Lord your God with all your heart, your mind, your soul, and your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. It's about worship and service. Think about the context of serving neighbor in marriage. We first have the most obvious, that husbands serve their wives and wives serve their husbands. And I'm not just talking about in our sexual intimacy, in our friendship, in our partnership, in our cultivation of communion. We also have the service of parents to children. Like, what a profound gift that God's given us to share in his creative power through the gift of procreation, through the gift of actually getting to rear a child in the fear and adoration of the Lord. Like, one of the most powerful things you'll ever do is be a mom or be a dad. Nothing you ever do in ministry will be more powerful or more profound than getting to shape human lives that God created, but that he brought into the world through you. We also have service from family to church. That the family, husband, wife, and children, is a foundational building block of the church. That those families are not just to be focused on the family, but they're to be people that open their home and practice hospitality and invite single brothers and sisters in and actually break bread and share. That the family, the Christian family, is a means through which God strengthens and stabilizes and honors and builds the church. And this is one that we forget quite frequently. It's the common grace gift of marriage and family, that family serves society. Like, this is the thing that so many people in our secular context don't get, is that throughout the history of the world, marriage and family has been the basic building block of society. And when it blows up, guess what happens to society? It blows up. So in the context of marriage, here's what we see. There's an invitation from God as Christians to have a uniquely Christian vision of sexuality that's rooted and grounded in the simplicity but the depth of worshiping and serving. Let's talk about worship and singleness real fast. Listen to this in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. I want you to be free from anxieties, Paul says. To the unmarried man is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to please the Lord. But the married man is anxious about worldly things, how to please his wife. And his interests are divided. And the unmarried or betrothed man is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to be holy in body and spirit. But the married woman is anxious about worldly things, how to please her husband. I say this to your own benefit, not to lay any restraint on you, but to promote good order and to secure your undivided devotion to the Lord. I just want you to get that when Paul talks about singleness as a vocation, he's talking about undivided devotion to the Lord. It's about worship. How radically different would Christian singleness be in our context if the first question we asked was, how do we offer our singleness to God in worship? How is it about fidelity to the Lord in response to his grace and actually honoring and praising him? The unmarried man is anxious about the things of the Lord, Paul says, how to please the Lord. And the unmarried woman is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to be holy in body and spirit. We've got to help the people of God in our context be formed around a vision of singleness that starts with asking questions of doxology. How do we worship in our singleness? Whether it's a lifetime calling to celibacy, or whether it's the calling to celibacy in a season of singleness, worship is the first thing that we should be seeking. Also, service. Listen to the words of Jesus. He says in Matthew chapter 19, the disciples come to Jesus and they say, if such is the case with a man and his wife, it's better not to marry. But he said to them, not everyone can receive this saying, but only those to whom it is given. There are eunuchs that have been so from birth. There are eunuchs that have been made eunuchs by men. And there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Let the one who is able to receive this receive it. We don't have time to get into all the history of this, but if you look at the ancient world, a eunuch was typically one that served in the court of a king. And becoming a eunuch, going through the painful process of castration, was about undivided devotion to the king and the king's line, so that the eunuch, as a high official in the court, wouldn't have a competing genealogy that would then be competing with the interest of the king and the king's family. It was a way to, in some ways, be absorbed into the family of the king for the strengthening of the king and the kingdom. And what Jesus is saying is that there's a calling to being spiritual eunuchs where we forego the gift of marriage and we forego the gift of procreation to serve the king, to be about the work of the king. It's about serving. It's about honoring. And I think what we got to fight for is not just doing the thing where we try to help every single determine if they have a lifelong calling to singleness or if they're called to a season of singleness. I do think that's an important conversation. But I think the thing that we got to emphasize is whether you're going to get married in 6 months and you're single today, or you're never going to get married, if you're a Christian, a uniquely Christian vision of sexuality around singleness is about worship to God, undivided devotion, and service in his kingdom, that we could give our lives away. So let's lead to the second thing real quick. Let's talk about sexuality and eschatology. This is real brief, but a couple of thoughts. Marriage does indeed communicate the goodness of creation. It's a reminder that God cares about our bodies, that sexuality matters, that procreation matters, that the continuation of the human race on this side of glory matters. But here's the thing that we often forget as we affirm the goodness of creation that marriage shows. We often forget that marriage is not ultimate. Listen to this in Matthew chapter 22. Jesus answered them, "You are wrong, because you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are they given in marriage, but are like the angels in heaven." Here's what's wild. Jesus, post-resurrection, is an embodied man. He's an embodied man. When we receive resurrection bodies, we're going to be men and women. But in glory, marriage and sexual intimacy in marriage is going to be done away with in the new heavens and the new earth. Because here's the thing that we tend to forget. Marriage is not ultimate. Marriage was created as a signpost. Sexual intimacy between a husband and a wife was created as a signpost that points past itself towards the consummation that's coming between God and his people. It's all about pointing to that day. And it's a gift to enjoy in the context of marriage now. But listen, the point of marriage is to point to the kind of union, the kind of knowing and being known that we're going to enjoy for all eternity with God and with one another in the absence of sin as God creates a new heavens and a new earth. When the fullness comes, signs are no longer needed. And what marriage was created to point towards, what sexual intimacy testifies of, will arrive in fullness in the great consummation when we're joined to the Lord. Think about this in singleness. To be single in the Lord is to live now as a prophetic witness of the not yet. To forego the gifts of marriage and sexuality is a way that our single brothers and sisters can actually be a prophetic voice to all Christians that reminds us that all of us are supposed to be sojourners and strangers here, that none of us are home yet, that we're to be very careful when we get too comfortable in this world, that we are just passing through, that this place is transient, that life is like a wisp of smoke that's here and gone. And what happens in Christian singleness is our Christian brothers and sisters forego good gifts for something greater. And that's the fact that they're living now, they're living in the now, in light of the not yet, they're reminding all of us that the point of marriage and singleness is not marriage and singleness, but it's pointing to the sufficiency of Jesus and the promises of God and the fact that we'll be with him for all time. And this is connected to desire. So let's just talk real quickly about sexual desire. I love C.S. Lewis and The Weight of Glory. It's just every word is beautiful. Let me just remind you of this one section. Lewis says, "It would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in the slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea, we are far too easily pleased." One of the places where our weak eschatology gets put on display most frequently is not knowing how to hold and navigate desires, especially our unmet desires. We have an invitation from the Lord in our desires to actually know that those desires are pointing towards something that's probably only going to be at best partially met on this side of the great day, that are given to us to lead us to something, to invite us to something, to cultivate in us hopeful longing and waiting. Think about sexual desire. Like, at the core of sexual desire is the desire to fully know and to be fully known, to actually fall into a relationship of such profound trust that you can be naked and unashamed with someone. And think about the ways in which marriage partially can fulfill that desire, but it never completely fulfills that desire. Because that desire itself is pointing beyond itself. It's reminding us that that desire to actually be seen fully and be accepted fully is only ours in Jesus. And we have it now through the finished work of Jesus, but we don't know how to fully enjoy it and experience it until we see him face to face. There's a day coming where that desire will be fully met. Think about the desire in sexual intimacy between a husband and a wife to procreate. I mean, it's a powerful, amazing thing that God is the one that creates people. He's the one that orders their days. And yet God uses the means of a man and a woman in the context of marriage, having sexual intimacy to bring this life into the world. It's in some ways co-creating with God. It's a powerful idea. Well, think about what that points to ultimately, that in the new heavens and the new earth, and I don't even know how to wrap my mind around this stuff, but in the new heavens and the new earth, there's ways in which we're going to, under Jesus, reign with him. We'll be heirs with him. And I don't know what that's going to mean, what that looks like in the universe, but I know that the Simpsons version of heaven is not what we're waiting on. Like, we're not going to be sitting around on clouds being bored all the time. We're going to be sharing with God. We're going to be reflecting as image bearers his creative capacities. Like, what would it look like if the sexual desires that we have that are both ordered and disordered, instead of terminating on themselves and always pointing back internally to what's broken or what's wrong, what if we started learning to hold our sexual desires in the presence of God and in the presence of God's people as a powerful reminder of what is and what is coming because of the work of Jesus? Think about loneliness. And by the way, like, we've got to do a better job of having conversations that marriage is not the cure to loneliness. Like, it's just not. You're still going to deal with loneliness in marriage. Both married and single people are at times lonely. And a lot of times we see that as simply a pathology to be cured. And there is a sense in which, of course, we have to fight for spiritual friendship. You know, I believe in that. Of course, we have to fight for communion. And there's a sense in which just giving up and being lonely the rest of our life, that's certainly not the answer. But there's also a sense in which the best relationships on this side of glory are never going to perfectly cure that ache that's inside your chest. That it's a reminder that you were made to share the kind of communion that's coming where we behold the face of God in Jesus. We were made for that. We long for that. The kind of knowing and being known that we can partially experience with each other, but that we can't fully even wrap our minds around. Because we still, as sinners by nature and choice, we still make fig leaves. And there's a day coming where loneliness gives way to the perfect beauty of being fully known and being fully accepted simultaneously. And I don't want to take away one bit from the nowness of what Jesus has accomplished in the gospel. Like, that is true now. The Father sees you completely and wants you and chooses you because of the finished work of Jesus. We just don't know how to fully experience that yet. And we should grow in that and seek to grow in that. But there's a day coming where loneliness gives way. The curtains are pulled back. We're going to see him. Think about, both in marriage and singleness, the desire for home. Like, the whole process of leaving and cleaving, God has imprinted that biologically inside of us. My teenage son, man, he's like a little ruddy buck right now. I can just tell this brother's about to go, man. He needs to go. He's hungry and seeking to go out in the world and create a home of his own. That's a good thing. That's a right thing. Okay, but think about how much our desire for place and presence and freedom and joy and security and beauty, which are all parts of our longing for home. Think about how much of that is a gift from God that's never going to be fulfilled on this side of the great day. That's to remind us that we're not home, but home is coming. When we see where we come from and we see where we're going, we have better tools to fight against sin and to cultivate Christian identity and to live out the uniquely Christian vision for sexuality that's different than the world.